each of which were the first to be certified gold, with his track Let Your Backbone Slide and debut album Symphony in Effect.
Let's take a closer listen to Maestro Fresh Wes's hit single Let Your Backbone Slide.
This jam is amplified, so just glide, glide, let your backbone slide.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, February 17th. I'm Chirag Mahajan with producer Morgan Yee. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to the UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Good evening. It is 5:02 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines today will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news across Canada, as well as news from around the world, syndicated from Democracy Now! And FSRN. All this, plus your weekend weather forecast, hopefully, if Phil shows up, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus headlines and your local news. Victoria Police Department announced earlier today that several dangerous police weapons have gone missing from the crowd management unit. The weapons include a Remington shotgun, tear gas canisters, tactical vests, anti-riot non-lethal Arwin rounds, and pepper balls. The police have launched a full-scale search for the weapons, which a spokesperson said are all easily identifiable as police property. Anyone who finds the missing equipment should not touch them, but call 911 immediately. The first of the Canucks rioters was sentenced to 17 months in jail with 2 years probation in Vancouver Provincial Court yesterday. Ryan Dickinson, age 20, pled guilty to the charges, which included participation in a riot. Judge Malcolm McLean said that Dickinson actively participated in the riots, citing Dickinson's use of police barricades to attack a police vehicle, and stated that his actions were not those of someone simply caught up in the moment. McLean said, quote, "Mr. Dickinson's participation was serious and involved a number of conscious and deliberate decisions on his part, starting with his decision to go downtown, knowing that would result in a breach of his bail." Unquote. Dickinson had been on probation for previous infractions at the time of the riot. Crown had approved 11 charges against 5 more suspected rioters, bringing the total so far to 140 charges against 52 people. Oceanside RCMP are investigating the attempt of theft of copper wire from a live telephone pole. RCMP in Errington on Vancouver Island were called out around 10:30 a.m. with reports of a downed pole. Officers reported that the pole, which was in an empty lot on private property, had been downed with a chainsaw, although no materials had been removed, as the thieves would likely have shocked themselves on the still live wires. The downed pole resulted in a nearby trailer park losing power, but BC Hydro crews quickly got it back on. This incident comes on the heels of a series of similar thefts from underground lines back in January and in December. No charges have been laid in regards to the theft, which cost BC Hydro an estimated $100,000. The BC Utilities Commission approved an interim increase, which will raise BC Hydro bills by 7.07% by April. This comes far above Premier Christy Clark's original 3.91% increase, a number intended to show that the government had concern for the increasing number of struggling families. Premier Clark's plan, which included an increase of 8% and then 2 years of a 3.9% increase. However, the Utilities Commission determined that the 3.9% increase was insufficient to repay BC Hydro's deferral accounts. Quote, "I'm not thrilled with the decision of the Utilities Commission," end quote, said Minister of Energy and Mines Rich Coleman, who last year began a review intended to significantly lower the planned hydro increases. At the time of the review, BC Hydro had proposed an increase of 9.73% over a three-year period to pay off its $2.2 billion public debt. Quote, "I think it puts a lie to the Premier's commitment to reduce rates," end quote, said New Democratic Party energy critic John Horgan. Quote, "You can't arbitrarily make the numbers smaller. The deferral accounts are the result of bad management, and our rates are going up as a result of that," end quote. That was NDP energy critic John Horgan. In a report released yesterday, Auditor General John Doyle said that the British Columbia government has failed to sufficiently replant the forests it manages and needs to develop a plan. Auditor General Doyle wrote that the government is responsible for 90% of the 22 million hectares of forested land that are available for timber production and harvesting in the province, but currently it is not managing the forests in a way that would reverse the trend of having less timber available for logging. Doyle's six recommendations include developing a plan for forest stewardship and investing enough in silviculture to achieve long-term timber goals, with silviculture being, of course, the growing and cultivation of trees. The Forest Lands and Natural Resource Operations Ministry, however, issued a statement in response to the report saying their ministry already has a management plan and is investing in reforestation. In interesting campus news, graduate students at UBC are presenting their thesis work in hopes of gaining cash prizes. Over 115 grad students have entered the three-minute thesis competition at UBC this year. It is the second time it has been held on campus and is one of the only three-minute thesis competitions held in North America. On top of having only 3 minutes, of course, competitors are also only able to use one PowerPoint slide in their presentations. Departmental heats are currently being held, leading up to the competition finals on March 2nd. Cash prizes for this year's competition have yet to be finalized. All heats and final events, of course, are open to the public. So for more information and event schedules, visit 3mt.grad.ubc.ca, or I'm sure if you Google 3-minute thesis competition, you are sure to find it. And those are your local and provincial headlines. We're going to take a quick break And stay right with us. We'll be back with your local weather forecast. News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia.
You got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Your neighborhood indie theater that promotes all things cool.
Friday, February 3rd, catch the East Van All-Stars Variety Show. East Vancouver's talent has come together for one night only to support the Rio Theater to survive through the recent closures due to a ban on movies at the neighborhood theater. Doors will be at 8 with the show at 9 p.m. This event is 19+, and cover will be by donation. Live concerts happening this month at the Rio include Patrick Malia presenting the Legion of Stand-Up Comedians on Saturday, February 4th, the Tongue-in-Cheek Spoken Word and Burlesque Show on Friday, February 10th, Charlie Tuna on the 18th, and Said the Whale on the 25th. To view the full schedule of live events this month at the Rio Theatre, visit riotheatre.ca/schedule. For more information on how to join the community's fight back against the banning of movies at the Rio Theatre, go to facebook.com/supporttherio.
WCCMC West Coast College.
Their new 20-month program is set to launch in May, so not only will you be receiving the best massage therapy education in the world, but you'll also be working faster as a registered massage therapist. Start a meaningful career and enjoy an almost 100% employment rate. Get more details today on how to become a registered massage therapist in only 20 months.
WCCMT.
Visit collegeofmassage.com.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. You can also listen to our podcasts and past interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. News 101 now has a Mixcloud page where you can access our past interviews as well. And now, the weather report will come after our international segment. We now go to Amy Goodman's interview on Democracy Now! With Juan Gonzalez. And they talk about a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist, a Middle East correspondent who died in Syria recently. And yeah, this is what they had to say about it.
Oh, Phil Chang, what up? By Marcel Khalife. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times foreign correspondent Anthony Shadid died of an apparent asthma attack yesterday while reporting on the conflict in Syria. One of the most celebrated journalists covering the Middle East, 43-year-old Shadid had been reporting inside Syria for a week, gathering information on the Free Syrian Army and other armed elements of the resistance to the government of President Bashar al-Assad. His photographer, Tyler Hicks, said Shadid had medication with him but began to show symptoms early Thursday before eventually suffering a fatal attack. Hicks later carried Shadid's body across the border to Turkey. He survived by his wife and two children. An American of Lebanese descent who spoke fluent Arabic, Shadid captured dimensions of life in the Middle East that many others failed to see.
Anthony Shadid's exceptional coverage won him a Pulitzer Prize in 2004 for international reporting while he was at the Washington Post on the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the occupation that followed. The Pulitzer Board praised Shadid's, quote, extraordinary ability to capture at personal peril the voices and emotions of Iraqis as their country was invaded, their leader toppled, their way of life upended, unquote. Shadid won a second Pulitzer Prize at the Washington Post in 2010, also for his Iraq reporting, and has since been nominated while at the New York Times for his coverage of the Arab Spring Uprising. This is Anthony Shadid reporting from Cairo for the New York Times last February, the night Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was forced out.
This is Anthony Shadid for the New York Times in Cairo. In some ways, one revolution may have ended tonight with the overthrow of President Hosni Mubarak, and another revolution may have begun. People are already making comparisons between Egypt's revolution and some of the most seismic moments in the Arab world, the 1967 Middle East War, or even the American invasion of Baghdad. That Arab world faces many of the same challenges that Egyptian youth face today. That's a demographic that is going younger and younger. The role of governments that have never quite responded to their people's demands for democracy, ineffectiveness of bureaucracies and entrenched interests of militaries, secret police, and big businesses that have profited off of neoliberal reforms across the region.
At last, after a lot of patience, the will of people won. The will of people won at last. At last he stepped down.
The test of how far these reforms go may prove the biggest challenge of Egypt's revolution. What the protesters were demanding over the past 18 days was a fundamental rethinking of Arab societies, the relationship of ruler to ruled. Already, we've seen reverberations across the region, Jordan, Yemen, Algeria, perhaps even Syria, which is under one of the most autocratic forms of government. Even the most optimistic think these changes, these reforms, these changes in society may take months, years, perhaps even decades. But then again, no one expected Egypt's revolution to unfold as quickly as it did. 18 days later, and President Hosni Mubarak has fallen.
Anthony Shadid reporting for the New York Times in Cairo last February. His work entailed great peril. In 2002, he was shot in the shoulder while reporting in Ramallah in the West Bank for the Boston Globe. Last March, Anthony Shadid and three other New York Times journalists were kidnapped in Libya by Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi's forces. They were held for 6 days, beaten before being released. Democracy Now! Spoke with Anthony Shadid shortly after he returned home. Today, we remember Anthony Shadid by going back to our interview with him in April of 2011. I began the interview by asking him to describe where he and his colleagues were at the time they were captured in Libya.
A day before I had gone back to Benghazi, I'd been covering the fighting at, I guess what you'd describe as the front in Libya, and I'd gone back to Benghazi, and I'd come that morning to a town called Ajdabiya because I think there was a sense, and at least I had the sense that this battle for this town might prove decisive somehow, that how that battle went would determine, it would have broader repercussions, I think, on the war, the civil war that we're seeing in Libya today. We had spent the day reporting that the fighting did begin that morning. We had spent the day going from the hospital to the front, interviewing residents in the town. And by about 4 or 4:30, we decided, we kept on hearing rumors that the government was in the town, that government troops were in the town. We didn't think that was happening. We thought they were still coming from the west. It turned out that they had encircled the town, and as we were leaving to go back to Benghazi, probably within, I'd say within a couple of minutes, we hit that checkpoint that they had set up just minutes before. The photographer, Lindsay, she saw the checkpoint first, and she thought it was government. We weren't sure. And I have to say, it felt like minutes, but it was probably just seconds when we drove right into the checkpoint. We passed the first line of soldiers, and then the second line of soldiers, I think, recognized that some people in the car were foreigners. And our driver yelled, "Journalist." And at that point, they pulled us out of the car, and almost instantly, as they pulled us out of the car, gun battle, unlike anything we'd ever seen, erupted. Rebels attacked the checkpoint, and we basically ran for our lives at that point.
So then talk about what happened. Who first took you? What happened at the checkpoint?
There was a look, I think, in those soldiers' faces of just fear and rage as they saw us, and they pulled us out of the car. Like I said, the gun battle started immediately, and when we ran, Tyler ran first, and then I fell on a sand berm and got to my feet, and then I ran after him. Lindsay and Steve followed, and we got behind a kind of a concrete shack, basically, to take cover from the shooting. And the soldiers set upon us there. They emptied our pockets, slapped us, beat us, and forced us onto our knees. And then I think, again, I'm going to say it was minutes, but it was probably just seconds. They told us to get on our stomachs, to lay flat on our stomachs, and we all resisted. I mean, I think all of us had the idea that if we were going to get on our stomachs, we might be shot or executed. We resisted, and they forced us down. And I remember looking up, hearing I remember him being a tall, lanky soldier saying, basically shoot them. I'm sure it was just a matter of seconds, but it did feel like minutes. Another soldier, looked at him and said, "You can't shoot them. They're Americans." And they soon after that, they tied our legs and our hands and threw us in two pickup trucks. And that kind of was the beginning of a 12-hour period where, every couple hours, every 3 hours, another gun battle, another fight with the rebels would start. We would pour out of the cars trying to take cover on the ground. And then by 2 a.m., they put us in a tank, drove us to another location, and that started a kind of a journey of 7 or 8 hours across the Libyan coast towards Sirte, where we were held in jail for a night.
And talk about who your captors were. Who were these soldiers, Anthony?
You know, it's interesting, Amy, because I kept on hearing this, the soldiers refer to the doctor. And, you know, pretty early on, you got a sense that it was more of a militia than an army. It was hard to identify any rank. Organization seemed a little bit haphazard. It was tough to see who was in charge or who wasn't in charge. And I kept on hearing this word, doctor. And then later on in the night, there was a reference to Dr. Mu'tasim. And this is one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons, considered, you know, hardliner, whatever that means. But and it did seem that that militia was loyal to him. At the stop that they took us the next morning, it was made clear that we needed to be put in the hands of Mukhabarat, that they're going to put us in the hands of intelligence. And I think that was the reason for the journey to Sirte. Once we got to Sirte, which is a pretty strategic town for the government, since it's Colonel Gaddafi's hometown, there was an effort to find out who we are, you know, where we had come from, you know, what we were doing. And then a decision by the next day was to take us to Tripoli, which we got to by a military airplane. I have to say that night in Sirte was one of the tougher ones, because you did get you came up with the realization that no one knew who we were or you know, where we had come from. At one point, I offered to my interrogator to transcribe our names in Arabic for him, if he would take off the blindfold, and he refused. But you know, it was a long night, because you thought this might last much longer than it actually did.
Anthony Shadid, can you talk about the moment of your release? What were you understanding at the time, you and your colleagues, and how it happened?
You know, we had been kept, and I have to say, once we arrived in Tripoli, we kind of just sprawled out in this. What we later learned was a headquarters for military intelligence. We just kind of sprawled out on the floor. We had been the beating at the on the tarmac in Sirte before we got on this military flight was pretty rough. And my colleague, even in Tripoli, my colleague Tyler got a pretty rough blow to the head with a gun. Once we got to this office of military intelligence, just kind of sprawled out on the floor. They gave us, you know, of all things, milk and mango juice, and, you know, kind of got our wits back together. And even in that meeting right there, they promised us that we were going to be treated well from then on. And they held they met their promise. We were absolutely treated well from then on. We were fed well. You know, the accommodations, it was a detention center, but it was actually quite pleasant. I think the only thing that was tough to deal with was the boredom in some ways, that we were trying to figure out what was going to happen to us. We had watched TV for a few minutes. We knew that we were still missing, but as soon as they saw our reaction to that, they cut the cable, so we didn't see TV after that, although we had heard that there was a debate over a no-fly zone. And we did worry about the implications of that. I think by the night before we were, or I'd say two nights before we were released, we could hear the anti-aircraft fire. We were in what they call Bab al-Azaziya, which is the headquarters for Colonel Gaddafi, so we figured that the no-fly zone had been imposed, that there was bombing going on. We did hear the anti-aircraft fire, and I think, you know, four journalists sitting together, they're just going to let their imaginations run wild, and they did, and we were worried that we would be kept days, weeks, even longer as, you know, as hostages, who knows. And again, it reminds me of what happened in Baghdad in 2003. I think a lot of journalists left Baghdad in 2003 because they feared what the Iraqi government would do. In the end, the Iraqi government did nothing to them before it fell. And I think there's a similar situation here. Again, you could tell from these officials that we talked to in Tripoli that they very much were determined to show that this was a legitimate state, that the state still had prestige, that this the state would play by diplomatic rules, essentially, and they did. And the Turkish diplomats who facilitated our release were told, I think, four times that we were about to be freed. The fourth time we actually were, and Sunday morning we were taken, we were blindfolded as we left the compound, and then taken to the Turkish, well, we were taken to a Libyan office, and then the Turkish embassy, and from there, we were driven to the Tunisian border.
And how did that feel?
You know, it felt, well, you know, I want to say, you know, you felt jubilant or you felt relieved, and I'm not sure that was the feeling. I think it was, more a feeling of, I don't think any of us talked all that much, to be honest. I think a lot of us had a lot of guilt over what, the fate of our driver, who was, we still don't know what has happened to him. We fear the worst, and that was the subject of a lot of our conversation over those 3 days in Tripoli. I think a lot of us felt guilt about what we had done to our friends and our families. We didn't know that anyone was even, we figured the New York Times was going to be paying attention to our case, but we didn't know that there were going to be efforts beyond that. And I think as soon as we got to Tunisia, we realized how much people had tried to help, and I think there was a deep appreciation on all our parts.
Anthony Shadid, we last spoke to you in Tunisia. This rolling rebellion that has been taking place, Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, Libya. Can you talk about the different natures of these rebellions, different characters, and also what makes them similar, what you've observed?
You know, I do think that Egypt and Tunisia were, in some ways, the easy revolutions. And they're revolutions that are still unfolding. And I think especially Tunisia, where the demands are very pronounced over what kind of change the opposition or the revolutionaries want to see in Tunisia. I think Egypt is absolutely still a work in progress, and I think it's a fascinating one. It's not coincidence that those two countries have, I think, the deepest sense of national identity. The divisions within those countries are not that great or not that pronounced. I think when we look at countries elsewhere in the Arab world, it does become much more complicated in some ways. I think we in Libya we have that problem that I was just talking about, the lack of any real institutions to navigate a transition. I think we look at countries like Bahrain, Yemen, and especially Syria, there are divisions, you know, ethnic sectarian divisions under the surface that I think frighten a lot of people, and I think especially so in Syria. I think Syria is the country that a lot of people are going to want to watch, that the implications of change there, I think, are as great as the implications were in Egypt. Syria is obviously a much smaller state. It doesn't have the power, the prestige. It doesn't have the history of Egypt. But it is at this kind of nexus of interest between Iran, Israel, Hezbollah, and Lebanon, and neighboring Lebanon. And I think any change in the calculus there, any change in the arithmetic in Syria is going to have far-reaching impacts across the region.
You are the Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times. Talk about Lebanon and Jordan.
You know, Lebanon, how do you describe Lebanon? It's remarkable to me that amid all this change in the region, and again, it's hard to overstate how great this change and this transformation is. I mean, I think for the first time, absolutely, since I can remember, but, you know, perhaps that a lot of people can remember, the region is speaking with an indigenous vocabulary. You know, it's speaking about its own vision. It's articulating its own vision. It's so radically, fundamentally different from the change that was, you know, imposed on Iraq with, you know, through invasion and violence in 2003. This is a remarkable moment, I think, in the history of the modern Arab world, and it's being articulated in a very forceful, fundamental way, in a way that's never been done before. Lebanon almost seems like a sideshow amid all these changes, and I think for a lot of Lebanese, it's difficult to see societies being transformed all around them, and Lebanon's still entrenched in this centuries-old or decades-old, let's say decades-old, system of rule that in some ways makes the smallest identities the most relevant, you know, form of affiliation. There is an effort, I think, in Lebanon to change that, to get beyond these narrow sectarian identities and create something more, something broader, some broader notion of belonging. But it's those efforts are so far hamstrung. There have been a few protests, but they really haven't gone anywhere. I think Jordan is going to be more interesting. And again, Jordan, I think, falls into that arithmetic that Syria still plays by. Jordan is obviously an American ally. You know, you don't see the American government abandoning the monarchy there anytime soon. But it's also a complicated society with its mix of Palestinians and Jordanians. The king, his wife are not popular. You keep thinking that this is going to be one of the places that we're going to see change, you know, rather quickly, like Algeria, for instance. But it hasn't happened so far. But again, this is a years-long process, and I think it is going to take years. And, you know, like I said, I think the easy revolutions are over. Now we're in store for a much more difficult, much more precarious, you know, but no less promising path toward, you know, fundamental change in across the region.
And then can you talk about the U.S. response to these rolling rebellions? President Obama giving the major address he did in Cairo soon after he was elected to the Muslim world. And then the responses to the despots who, not just Obama, but the administrations before, had shored up for decades and holding on to the end and then seeing when it's inevitable making the shift. Can you talk about what the role has been?
Sure. You know, I have to say, just, you know, at the outset, it's so, you know, as a reporter in Iraq, it so much was about Iraq and America, this conflict between, I mean, obviously the United States invaded that country and the society was wrecked over, you know, over truly heartbreaking conflict that went on for years. It did strike me in Egypt, especially in Tahrir Square, when, now, absolutely, there was criticism of U.S. policy, criticism of Israel, but I think fundamentally the narrative that you heard in Tahrir Square was about what kind of Egypt are we going to construct, what kind of Egypt are we going to build, what is our vision for the future, especially vis-a-vis a government that basically kind of, you know, let's be blunt, a government that pretty much hated its people. That was remarkable to me. And again, I keep using this phrase, but it was an indigenous vocabulary. It was a narrative that was being articulated on its people's own terms in Cairo and elsewhere. You know, I think the United States almost by default feels like it has to get involved, but you get the sense being in a place like Tahrir Square that the less involved they are, the better it's going to be. I think critics out there would see a level of cynicism on how this is unfolding in terms of U.S. and Western intervention. I think it's no coincidence that France and Italy, both with, you know, interests in the future of Libya's oil, were the first to recognize Libya's opposition government along with Qatar. And I think critics are right to point out that, you know, we haven't seen a uniform standard in how American and Western intervention plays across the region. We saw a much more forceful response in Libya compared to what we've seen in Yemen or Bahrain. Yemen and Bahrain obviously both being strategic allies to the United States and the West. American intervention has a pretty sad history in the Arab world, and you do wonder, you know, how well that lesson is understood as we go forward, because it is, like I keep saying this, I hate to be repeating myself, but it is going to be much more dangerous and much more violent as we go forward. And I think there's going to almost be almost a fallback, how do I put this? There's going to be a desire to intervene, I think, as this gets more dangerous and more complicated and more violent. But I think that very intervention could very well make things worse.
In what way make it worse?
Well, what way? This is probably beyond my pay grade, but it's, I'm trying to think when it's gone well. Any time over the past, you know, couple generations, and I don't see it necessarily going well anytime soon. There is a dynamic, I think, that violence, especially violence imposed from abroad, imposes on these societies, and that dynamic, almost always promises unintended consequences, and it did in Iraq. It's doing that in Libya right now. I think this very prospect of what we're seeing, the violence in Libya, is going to have repercussions that are going to last for a long time, and I think that model of, or let's say those unintended consequences, are something that almost by default happen with any intervention anywhere.
Anthony, are you planning to go back to the Middle East?
You know, I'm the bureau chief in Beirut, so I'm going back next week. But like I said, Lebanon's probably the quietest place in the Middle East right now. So I do want to try to hopefully get to Egypt, rather soon. I think one of these key narratives to better understand when you look at the Arab world right now is this kind of deal that's going to be made between political Islam and power. And I think that's something that's unfolding right now. I think we're seeing it in Egypt unfold in a pretty forceful way. And it's a lot less dangerous to cover something like that, and I think in some ways more interesting. So I'm hoping to try to tackle that when I get back.
What makes you keep going back? You were shot in the shoulder in the West Bank in 2002. Why do you keep going back to war zones?
You know, not to be flip, but it's kind of pretty much the only thing I know how to do, not cover conflict. I actually don't like covering conflict. I think you have to cover conflict when it's part of what you do cover, and I do cover the Arab world. I've been covering it for 15 years. I think now, finally, is the moment that we see that is transformative in the Arab world, and it does make you even more, I think, eager in some ways to cover it, to try to bring meaning to it, to witness it. And it matters, I guess. I think at each time you make these decisions, say in Baghdad in 2003 and Lebanon in 2006, you know, as you pointed out, in Ramallah in 2002, you think that if you're not there, the story won't be told. And that, you know, that might be a little bit arrogant or conceited. It's absolutely altruism. It's the only way to bring altruism to the story, that it's not just about ambition, that you're trying to do something that's meaningful. You know, I hope that's the case. It's probably a mix of all of them together. But you do want to, I think especially people who've been covering this for a long time and who have a sense of the place, I think those people, want to have a role at least in how these stories, how these conflicts, how these uprisings are covered.
Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times foreign correspondent Anthony Shadid speaking last April. He died of an apparent asthma attack yesterday while reporting on the conflict in Syria. He's survived by his wife, New York Times reporter Nada Bakri, and two children. Anthony Shadid was 43 years old. To see the full interview and all of our interviews with Anthony Shadid, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Back in 30 seconds.
إلى خبزي أمي وقهوتي ولمسة أمي أحن إلى خبزي.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. What you just heard was Amy Goodman. A past interview of Amy Goodman with Anthony Shadid, New York Times Middle East correspondent who recently passed away in Syria. Thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview. Up next, we've got Phil from the UBC Storm Club right here in our studio to give us your local weekend weather update. Over to you, Phil.
All right. Thank you, CJ. Let's get started. It will be
sunshine and lollipops and unicorns and cute fluffy bunnies this weekend. No, that's actually just me watching too much Dr. House. A very moist weekend is what we're in for, or so the giant clump of moisture on the radar suggests. Things will be much like what it is today. Along the coastlines, the southeastern winds are going to be a howling 30 kilometers per hour, with gusts up to 50 kilometers per hour, so definitely staying away from the beaches is strongly advised. The most intense portion of the system is probably going to pass by us around Saturday evening, possibly bringing us thunderstorms in our metro area and snowfall in the mountains. Now, here is your three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, rain, low of 5. Saturday, rain, estimating around 25 millimeters of accumulated precipitation, high of 10, low of 6. Sunday, cloudy with periods of rain, high of 8, low of 4. So that's your weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 6 degrees here on campus. I'm with CJ and Morgan in the sub. See you all again in 2 weeks, after reading week. For News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil, for that weekend weather update. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Stay tuned. We will be right back after a PSA.
The Honorable Emery Barnes was first elected NDP MLA in 1972 and subsequently re-elected 4 consecutive times. In 1991, he was appointed Deputy Speaker, and in 1994 became the first Speaker in British Columbia to be elected by a secret ballot of his peers. He was also the first Black person to hold this position in any Canadian province. A member of the opposition party remarked, "Your personal dignity, honor, and integrity are beyond question and reproach, and you are a most fit individual to sit in this very important position as Speaker." The main focus of his life and career was helping the disadvantaged in society, with strong emphasis on social justice, poverty, worldwide human rights, and world peace. He was active in developing awareness of Black history in BC and furthering the principles of multiculturalism, particularly in the public sector. Barnes was appointed to the Order of British Columbia in 1995.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
You are cordially invited to the Association of Canadian Archivists Student Chapter's 4th International Student Symposium. This year's theme, Unpacking the Digital Shoebox, the Future of Personal Archives. With an assembled, eclectic, and innovative group of international speakers, attendance is open to all information enthusiasts, students, and faculty. For more information, check out the website at www.slais.ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. You can listen to past shows and past interviews at our website, citr.ca/news. Up next, we've got your international headlines brought to you by fsrn.org.
Shelling continued today in the Syrian city of Homs, less than 24 hours after the UN General Assembly passed a resolution condemning government violence against civilians. UN members voted 137-12 to pass the non-binding resolution. The U.S. House of Representatives passed energy legislation Thursday that included a provision that could allow the Keystone XL pipeline to go forward. The amendment attached to the House energy bill would take the decision out of the administration's hands. California Representative Henry Waxman spoke to FSRN about the vote.
The Republicans are obsessed with this Keystone pipeline. They have it as one of the pillars of their jobs efforts.
The House energy bill also includes provisions to open up offshore oil drilling in the Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf, and in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The bill still has to go to the Senate, where these provisions will likely be challenged. Two barges collided this morning on the Mississippi River near New Orleans, spilling oil into the waterway. Investigators closed a 5-mile stretch of the river while they assessed the spill, according to the AP. The amount of oil leaked has not been determined, but parish officials downplayed any threat to people in the area. In other oil spill news, the Venezuelan government says it has contained about 90% of the crude oil leaked into the Guarapiche River. The pipeline rupture happened on February 4th, and residents are angry because the spill has compromised their water supply. For FSRN, Rachel Boothroyd reports from Caracas.
The government says that more than 2,000 employees from state oil company PDVSA are currently collaborating with members of the local community in efforts to clean up the river. The workers are using absorbent barriers to contain the oil and to prevent it from spreading. Images posted by the Associated Press show oil-covered men without protective gear working in the blackened river. In response to the incident, the government closed down a nearby water purification plant, with residents in the nearby city of Maturin protesting on Wednesday, complaining that they had not had access to water for more than a week. Maturin Mayor José Vicente Macavares said that the purification plant is expected to reopen within the next 10 days. The exact amount of oil leaked is still unknown, although the government has qualified it as minimal. Rachel Boothroyd, FSRN, Caracas.
Europe's highest court has ruled that online services such as Facebook and YouTube cannot be forced to police their customers' use of music, movies, or other copyrighted material. Digital activists say it's another blow to the anti-piracy initiative known as ACTA. From France, FSRN's Leah Moriarty has more.
The European Court of Justice shot down a lawsuit by a Belgian association that collects royalties for authors, composers, and other artists. The group sued to require an online social network to monitor its users' postings and prevent unauthorized use of copyright-protected material. But the court ruled that would violate European law and strike an unfair balance between copyright protection and freedom to conduct business online. Digital activists say this ruling, and a similar one last fall dealing with internet service providers, invalidates a key element of ACTA. Jeremy Zimmerman is with the Paris-based group La Quadrature du Net.
There is now a heavy trend from the entertainment industry to try to make the internet intermediaries bear the liability for enforcement of this obsolete vision of copyright.
Meanwhile, ACTA continues to take its lumps. In the last week, Germany, Latvia, Bulgaria, and the Netherlands became the latest countries to suspend ratification of the trade agreement. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
New Jersey lawmakers have passed legislation legalizing same-sex marriage, but despite support from both legislative bodies, the state's Republican Governor Chris Christie has vowed to veto the bill. In light of the challenge faced in New Jersey, Maryland may beat them to the punch. Their lawmakers are meeting today to debate a same-sex marriage bill that was introduced by Democratic Governor Martin O'Malley. The vote in the House is expected to be very close, as supporters and opponents have been vigorously lobbying lawmakers throughout the week. FSRN's Clayton Kahn reports from Baltimore.
The bill, known as the Civil Marriage Protection Act, passed two House committees on Tuesday. But going into the debate today, there were still serious doubts if Democrats had rallied enough support to push through the legislation. A similar bill died in the House last year following opposition from several African-American Democrats, who are hesitant to back the bill that is largely opposed by the state's African-American clergy. Reverend Meredith Moise, co-chair of Baltimore Black Pride and supporter of the bill, says that the issue of same-sex marriage needs to be confronted by African-Americans.
What we're doing at Baltimore Black Pride is we are mobilizing African-Americans, same-gender-loving African-Americans, and also our heterosexual allies to really talk about the love aspect of this. And this is also a broader conversation in our community in terms of being same-gender-loving and being African-American and being Afro-Caribbean and how that impacts us.
The Maryland Senate has not taken up the legislation, but passage there is expected to be easier. Clayton Kahn, FSRN, Baltimore.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
During his visit to the U.S. this week, China's Vice President Xi Jinping has met protesters in Iowa and Washington, D.C. In Los Angeles, where the leader is visiting today, protesters gathered downtown with signs that read, "Stop killing Tibetans in Tibet" and "Shame on you, China." Xi Jinping's U.S. tour has reignited criticism of human rights issues, and within China there has been a wave of protests targeting environmental problems. Citizens have brought attention to chemical plants, waste incinerators, and toxic spills. Although China's government tolerates more dissent today, environmental activists and NGOs face surveillance and a legal system that favors polluters. FSRN's Mike Ives has more from Dailan, China.
It's late afternoon on a winter day in Dalian, a prosperous port city in northeastern China. Amid the bustle of traffic and street vendors, a Chinese activist in her mid-20s taps on a laptop inside the brick-faced office of a local nonprofit organization. The office sits above a barber shop in a residential neighborhood. Reams of environmental magazines and pamphlets line a floor-to-ceiling bookshelf, and the air is cold enough to make you shiver. The activist won't give her name, fearing it could jeopardize her organization's work, but she agrees to discuss a protest against a Dalian chemical plant that gripped the world's attention last summer. For years, she says, Dalian residents had concerns about the risk of toxic spills in the city's industrial zone. After a tropical storm broke a dike near a paraxylene chemical plant last August, many thought a spill was imminent. So they joined forces online and decided to hit the streets in protest.
In the face of all of these problems that have been brought about by the overly rapid development of Dalian, people here finally reached a point when they couldn't take it anymore, and they set out to make their voices heard.
On August 14th, an estimated 12,000 people marched through Dalian in a largely peaceful demonstration, the Associated Press reported. As a result, a city official promised to shut the controversial plant and move it farther away from the city's downtown. Industrial pollution by private and state-owned companies is widespread in China. Last month, in southern Guangxi province, toxic waste containing the chemical cadmium was illegally released along a 190-mile stretch of a river, threatening downstream water supplies for millions of people. Agence France-Presse reported that the spill prompted local officials to arrest seven executives from companies that allegedly caused the spill. Foreign companies also come under fire for sourcing products from Chinese factories accused of environmental and labor violations. Last October, executives from Apple met with environmentalists after a Beijing-based group accused the U.S. company's Chinese factories of improper waste disposal, a claim that Apple denied.
I mean, many business are private. Many people are no longer working for the governmental agencies. So they can say no to government. In the past,
Wen Bo is a leading Chinese environmental activist. He says after witnessing decades of breakneck economic growth, people across China are noticing contamination in their midst. Even those who don't have high environmental awareness, he says, are starting to take action against polluters. But Wen says environmental campaigning in China is limited by institutional barriers. Although the ruling Communist Party tolerates more dissent today than it did 12 to 15 years ago, it actively prevents Chinese NGOs from gaining too much power and influence. Even when residents and activists manage to sue, Wen says, courts often rule in favor of polluters.
If there is a normal channel, the people would pursue this normal channel. But in current society, in current situation in China, there's no such a normal process, mostly because the polluters are actually in bed with government. They are in bed with government officials. So the government actually serve as an umbrella for many of these polluters, as protection for them. So there's no justice the public can see.
It's a weekday morning in Beijing, the sprawling Chinese capital. Although this city of about 20 million has modernized in a hurry over the last three decades, it still suffers from chronic air pollution.
The past three decades, China has pretty much put all its energy into developing the economy.
Tom Wang is the Beijing-based communications director for Greenpeace East Asia. He says environmental conflicts are especially acute in rural areas, and in contrast to city dwellers that stage peaceful demonstrations, farmers sometimes react violently to toxic hazards that threaten their health, land, and livelihoods.
In the countryside, the direction is quite likely a very, let's say, dramatic eruption, kind of thing, like a volcano, if things don't get addressed immediately, really.
Meanwhile, city dwellers across China wonder whether their demonstrations will help to stem industrial pollution in the medium and long term. In 2009, residents of the southern megacity Guangzhou protested a plan to build a waste incinerator. But Kamen Li, a 24-year-old Guangzhou resident, says city officials have decided to forge ahead with construction. Now, instead of protesting, Li and others are trying to ensure that the plant will be operated safely.
We kind of avoid the harm of the incineration, but we can reduce the harm of the during the operation process. So the communities. Voices comes out. It will help the government to improve the operation of the incinerator.
In Dalian, the northeastern port city where residents staged a protest last summer, it's still unclear what will happen to that chemical plant they were worried about. Although city officials closed the plant in August and promised to relocate it farther away from downtown, the plant reopened a few months later. Now residents are holding their breath and waiting to see if the government will keep its word. Mike Ives, FSRN, Dalian, China.
As Syrian officials make plans for the constitutional referendum scheduled for later this month, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said they are preparing for a worsening Syrian refugee crisis in Lebanon. From Beirut, FSRN's David Enders reports.
The announcement of the referendum comes at a time when violence plagues a number of Syrian cities, particularly those along the Lebanese border. Syrian government troops have been shelling the city of Homs for 2 weeks, and the Syrian army has reportedly invaded neighborhoods in the city of Hama, north of Homs, as well. Syrian citizens, despite difficulties, continue to flee to Lebanon. The UN Refugee Agency has registered more than 6,000 Syrian refugees in Beirut and northern Lebanon. Officials estimate that another 2,000 to 3,000 are now living in the Bekaa Valley, in eastern Lebanon. Astrid Vingenderen Stort is the UNHCR's senior protection officer in Beirut.
First of all, more than 90% are housed in host families, which is also, we keep on wondering when do we reach a saturation point, because it's very tough to host families for such a long time. We had expected a much larger influx and more registration after what has been happening in Homs, and it didn't come. Now, does this mean that the people didn't come, and why didn't they? Maybe the people moved inside Syria to other places.
But the refugee problem may be even worse. Lebanese activists who have formed a coalition of NGOs to aid refugees estimate the number of Syrians that have fled to Lebanon since mass demonstrations against the Syrian government began nearly 1 year ago could be as high as 20,000. Some do not register with the UN because they don't need aid. Others avoid registering out of fear of being identified. Abu Mahmoud left the village of Tal Kalik on the Lebanese-Syrian border with his family 9 months ago.
It is very hard here, but you get used to it. Sometimes there is work, sometimes there is not. I cannot go back until the system has fallen. It's very dangerous.
Many of those fleeing the violence need basic aid, like food and water. Abdullah Tassi is a Lebanese doctor from Zahle, about 20 miles west of the Syrian border. He has been active in sending humanitarian supplies into Syria and aiding those who have fled to Lebanon. Tassi described a growing crisis in places like the Damascus suburb of Zabedani, which has now seen nearly 2 weeks of government offensives and temporary ceasefires between government troops and the militiamen, many of whom are army defectors now fighting to protect the movement that grew out of peaceful protests.
We have 39 families in Bikar from Zabedani. None of them is accepting to talk to any reporter. This is how bad the situation is. 10 to 20% of the people are there, and 80% they escaped to Madaya and to Lantus.
As the Syrian government has reportedly deployed more of its soldiers along its traditionally porous border with Lebanon. There have also been reports the Syrian military has recently laid mines along some parts of the border. Nonetheless, Tassi said the flow of refugees into Bekaa had remained consistent, and that activists had begun petitioning the government for permission to build a refugee camp there. David Enders, FSRN, Beirut.
In Bahrain's capital today, police responded to protesters with force as they marched toward the part of the city known as the Pearl Roundabout, where 1 year ago they began an uprising against the minority Sunni monarchy. A video posted today on YouTube shows thick smoke filling a street in Manama as security forces gather on a corner. Flames shoot out from a building on the side. Mohammed Al-Maskati, president of the Bahrain Youth Society for Human Rights, took part in the march. He told FSRN via cell phone that the arrests began early in the day.
Actually, from early morning, the security forces surrounding the villagers and attacking the protesters who are heading to Pearl Roundabout, arresting some of the protesters and arresting human rights activists only a few hours ago. One of them is our colleagues, and another one is Nabil Rajab. They shot us when we tried to head into the Pearl Roundabout, and they hit. They shot the cars or close to the Pearl Roundabout.
You mentioned two of your colleagues that were arrested. One of them is Nabil Rajab, who has been a guest on our program in the past. He's with the Bahrain Center for Human Rights and has been the subject of government arrests in the past. What is his status now?
Actually, our lawyer is now in the police station, different police station, because Mr. Nabil Rajab is taken to the Hura police station. He will get interrogation in a few hours. Still, we don't know what the charges, but we are waiting to see what they are taking action against.
But they are both in police custody right now.
Yeah, both in the police custody, and we don't know their situation because we don't get any calls.
There have been reports of police using tear gas and stun grenades on protesters. Can you confirm that?
Yes, actually, we get shot by the security forces when we are trying to reach the Pearl Roundabout. We are close to our cars. We are trying only to move to the Pearl Roundabout, and we got shot heavily by security forces and some of the police using tear gas, using rubber bullets, shotguns, and sound bombs.
Were there injuries from the tear gas being used and the grenades?
I don't know if there's any injuries, but close to me there was not any injuries, but another injuries, actually.
The Pearl Roundabout is the site that protesters occupied last year, also where police have raided. Was it accessible today? Were you able to reach it on the march?
Actually, there is a checkpoint everywhere to prevent anyone to go to the Persecoy. We're trying to reach at meters close to the Persecoy. We got shot, we got some people.
Apologies to FSRN for canceling that interview. We're going to end this show pretty soon because the sports team is in a rush to broadcast the awesome sports game. That's our program for Friday, February 17th. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact news@citr.ca. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Today's show was produced by Morgan. Yeah. Stay tuned for the sports broadcast right now.
Well, hello, good evening, welcome from McKinnon Gymnasium in Victoria, British Columbia for tonight's live Canada West women's basketball action, UBC at Victoria Vikes. And alongside Howard Sumora, I'm Jason Wang. Very nice to have you along. And Howard, we just missed the first two plays off Steph off, but the Vikes have a 4-2 lead in the ball back.
Yeah, and clearly this is a test from a UBC perspective, Jason, to see how much intensity they have already having locked up the Pacific Division. This Vikes team obviously wanting to get to the playoffs, and it's do or die for them tonight. They're going to have that early energy.